我是贝西李倩玲，欢迎收听今天的备忘录。今天的备忘录有点特别，因为它是一集英文的备忘录。我2023年年底回英国休假的时候呢，联系上了 Brompton Bike 小布折叠自行车的 CEO Will Butler Adams， 我邀请他上备忘录来聊一聊。我2024年呢录制的第一集的备忘录的内容呢，就是跟小布的 CEO Will 来聊一聊小布的商业模式。这么一个注重工艺、重质不重量的折叠自行车为什么要进中国，小布在中国的发展， Will 对中国消费者的观察，还有就是小布在中国被喜爱的程度到底跟其他市场有没有什么不一样等等的内容，欢迎大家的收听。这一期的内容呢，我们也准备了英文的文字稿以及中文的翻译，两份的文字稿同步更新在备忘录家的公众号上，欢迎大家参考。
I wanted to thank you so much for agreeing to appear on my show. I mean, global CEO of such a, you know, brand with such history.
Yep.
You could have just said no. We're just a nobody, right? A little podcast out of China.
I couldn't agree less. See, if all you do is what you're meant to do, it's too boring. That's why I love random dinners. I love LinkedIn because random things come in. I get stuff on Instagram. I mean, you know, it's a fairly full-time job because there's stuff coming in, WeChat, you know, and, you know, like when you go to dinners or anything else, half of them are a bit of a waste of time, but you never know which half. It's the same with looking at messages. 80, 90% of the message I get are dross. But I troll through them because inside you meet interesting people, little funny things happen. And you've got to keep doing that. Otherwise you just become boring and you just do the day job and all you worry about is the P&L and, you know.
I couldn't believe you accepted my LinkedIn invitation. Because when I did that, I was like, such a long shot. I'm sure he will not accept it. So when you did accept it, I'm like, oh my God, is this the real,
maybe it's a fake account.
Or maybe just a robot, I don't know, accepting random invitations.
That's me at some point on the weekend going beep, beep, beep.
But yeah, such achievement ever since you became the CEO of Brompton. If I was looking at your turnover, your financials, you know, correctly, as of 2022,
yep.
The turnover versus when you first took on the CEO job, 50-fold? From £2 million to 107, almost 107 million pounds. Oh my God, more than 50-fold.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I don't see it like that.
How did you see it then?
We haven't done our job. We are permanently, I mean, I love our staff. I'm so proud of them. But we are permanently screwing up. We're permanently shooting ourselves in the foot and looking in hindsight and going, oh my God, why did we do that? You Muppet, you should have done this. And and the world is not where it needs to be. We facing such colossal challenges to how we live. And those challenges are only going to get greater. And some of the solutions are right there. And one of them has happened to be my career. And yet, I don't feel my impact, because it's needed so much, has been sufficient. Yes, we've done well, but how is it that we have still so much problems in how people live in cities with air quality, with mental health, physical health? And we live in cities. Most humans in planet Earth now live in cities. So the city, if we're the super smart, amazing human being, the place where we all live should be the coolest place to live, the healthiest place to live, the most culturally rich place to live, where the health outcomes are the best. And actually, in many cities, that isn't the case. And the irony is, we know that active travel, which is really walking and cycling, works for cities. The distances people travel, it works. It's not the solution, but it's a huge part of the solution. But our cities have not been designed for that. That's virtually been low tech. No, no one makes any money from it. So how are we going to do it? We're going to put the car at the center, or we're going to, you know, put an incredibly expensive, you know, metro system. So no one has to even, you know, hardly get out of bed. well, that's not going to make us happy. Because, you know, it's all fine and well looking on YouTube and seeing somebody with a six pack who's been on a 28-day cardio thing, but they'd never bloody, that's not real. Mm-hmm. And who's got the time to spend 3 hours at the gym every day? I haven't. For me, I've just got to be going somewhere. And if a bike gets me there faster and it isn't raining, I'll take it.
Mm.
And it's just more convenient. Mm. And suddenly, without even realizing it, I'm just feeling better.
Right.
And that's, we've made real progress, but whew, we haven't even started.
But you became CEO 2008.
Yes.
And Brompton entered China 2012. So
yes.
you are the person behind that decision.
Yes.
And the driver of that China strategy.
But I would say I joined the company in 2002.
Yeah.
And I was pretty much leading it from 2006. So these things have been on my mind and were in development even before 2006,
mm.
because the first major step was taking Japan and putting it into a place where we were really engaged with our distributor. We had a fantastic distributor. We finally taken back distribution from them.
Mm.
They still have shops and we're still great friends, but it was time for us to take over. But we had 20 years plus of a great relationship. But we started in Japan, and at the time, and I would probably still recommend for a lot of businesses, British businesses anyway, that Japan is a good place to start, because doing business in Japan, as long as you're patient, is very safe. The Japanese are so careful and trusting and sort of diligent and care for your brand. And, you know, you don't have to be a soupy, savvy, war-torn, you know, great, you know, business person. You can be a lovely person and not be hurt. And you, through Japan, Korea will see what you're doing.
Mm.
China will see, you know, everybody in Asia wants to visit Japan.
Mm.
And they will see a little bit of your brand and you will learn. And we started in Japan. And then the next step was probably Singapore and Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
And the key for us was then Hong Kong. Because once we started selling in Hong Kong, we thought we were selling to Hong Kong. But what we discovered is we were selling to Shenzhen.
Of course.
And we realized completely, you know, we hadn't even thought about it.
You didn't expect that?
No.
When you were...
We, you know, all these people think great businesses, oh, they're doing all these business plans and research. And no way. We just had a few people from London who'd been to Hong Kong and they were riding it. Then their friends wanted some, and then their friends' friends wanted some. And then we eventually, a distributor said, hey, look, quite a few guys have been turning up with your bike. Is anyone distributing it in Hong Kong? Can I do it? This was Mr. Lee from Flying Ball.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome bike shop in Kowloon.
Mm.
And so we got started. And then he said, oh, he's such a lovely man. His son's taken over, third generation.
Wow.
He said, yeah. Maybe I'll sell 50 or 60 first year, like 300 bikes. Woo! And one, they were far more popular than he anticipated in Hong Kong. And two, of course, people coming from Shenzhen and buying them. So that was where the first realization that we had a product that was relevant, that people were interested in.
Mm.
And then, you know, if you're happy with me wittering on,
no,
we then... Then the real adventure began. I had a guy called Quinton working for me, lovely guy. He'd been living in Taiwan, spoke Mandarin and understood Asia to a far better degree than I did. And we thought, right, okay, people are buying in China. So we've got to find some distributors. We did a teeny weeny bit of research. I'm all for doing the least amount of research possible.
Mm-hmm.
Get out there before you do the research.
Yeah.
Go on a holiday, a trip. Just go for it. 5 days, 10 days. Then if you think it's got potential, then do the research. But don't spend 3 years doing research and then do your first visit. Get the first visit in and then do the research.
Mm.
Anyway, we went. And our plan was, with this brilliant plan, we'd done us what we thought was some strategy. And we were going to find regional distributors because China's so ginormous.
Yeah.
Regional distributors of different parts of China. So our brilliant plan. So we thought, well, we'll do Beijing and Shanghai. I had actually been to Shanghai before. Not in the context of selling. That was in the context of buying titanium.
Mm.
And so we went to Beijing. First of all, freezing cold and windy.
Which
and I wasn't
month
expecting
was it?
That. You... Well, sometime around winter. It was
okay.
Fripping freezing. And we were staying out near the sort of Olympic Village.
Yeah.
and pedaling miles into central Beijing. You know, my hands are freezing. We managed to find like 5 or 6 shops. They thought we were a joke. They were selling to expats, you know, really smart road bikes. It was either expat road bikes or like cheap as chips bikes stuff that's piled up high in some old shop. No one was interested. And we turned up and we danced around with our bike. They weren't interested. Then we went to Shanghai. I thought, well, maybe we make a bit of better progress there. Basically, it was the same. A little bit better, but they were just... And then Ben, who's our distributor in Taiwan, said, oh, Will, I've got a friend of mine, Thomas. He loves Brompton. He's Taiwanese, but he's been out in Shanghai for years. He runs his agency, and he basically, he's in the luxury world, and... You know, he knows all about shopping malls and designing stores for watch companies. His wife, Yuning, was PR director for Piaget, Richemont Group, you know, real dude. So I'm like, oh, I'll have a cup of tea with him. So I met Thomas. He rocks up on his Brompton in the French Quarter in Shanghai. And like you can see from me, fashion is not my thing. I'm practical. So, I mean, Thomas, who's still a great friend, he rocks up wearing the most ridiculous glasses you've ever seen, wearing the weirdest clothes, the sort of weirdest jacket. His hair is cut and long and weird. If I did any of those things, I'd look like an idiot. But he looked like the coolest dude you've ever seen. Some people can just pull it off. I'm not one of them. He rolls in. Oh, well, you know, dude. Yeah, it's so cool. And we get chatting, get on really well. By the time we have had our cup of tea, I said, look, you know, Thomas, nobody wants to take our bike. No one's interested, but I'm sure we've got potential. Why don't we do it together? $50,000, $50,000 each. And then we said, we better ring up Ben in Taiwan, because he was the middleman.
Yeah.
So while before we'd finished our second cup of tea, $50,000 from Ben in Taiwan, $50,000 for Thomas. $50,000 from us. We started with $150,000, set up a company, opened our first store in the French Quarter.
Oh my God. That's how it all started.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So if you have not, well, Ben has not introduced you to Thomas, the entry in China will probably come much later.
Yes, it would have done. And the first shop was a complete disaster.
In what way?
Well, it was a beautiful shop. It was like 200 years old in the French Quarter in Shanghai with the lovely plane trees in front. And it was gorgeous and everything about it was beautiful. I suppose it's what the shop we wanted if we were in Paris or if we were in London. The trouble is, if no one has heard of your brand and you're a destination store, standalone, maybe today we could get away with it, but no way in those days. Because what I have learned, maybe wrongly, but is particularly in China, the consumer is very sophisticated and understands that they want the real deal because there is a lot of smoke and mirrors. The way they establish the real deal is adjacencies. So if you're in a shopping mall, the shopping mall will not let in anyone who is not the real deal. They won't let them in. They'll have done their research. And who are the other stores in that mall to give you confidence that if there's a brand you haven't heard of, it must be a quality brand because they wouldn't let it in. And these other stores wouldn't. So when you're a new brand going into China, if you plonk yourself on some street with just random shops, it might be beautiful and lovely, where your destination, no one's going to hear about you. No one's going to know about it. They need to be coming for something else. And in coming for something else, they see you. Oh, what's that? Hey, that's interesting. Never heard of it. Oh, then the research begins, you know, and there's a lot of research. So we got that wrong, but then we got into Parkview Green in Beijing, lovely little store there. And then we moved into K11. Is that right? In Shanghai? Can't remember. You know, and we started, but we were never interested in selling loads of bikes. It's always been the same, particularly in the first few years. All you want is the customer you do sell to love it. Because those first customers are everything. They're the most precious brand ambassadors you can have. So to the point where, and we still say this, we're not about selling bikes. We're about selling bikes to the right person. If you're good at selling, you can sell something to anyone. But if they don't need it, somebody might buy a Brompton because they think it's trendy. But if they don't need it and they're not going to use it, then don't buy it because you'll never love it. You love it because you use it, because you meet friends, because you discover your city, because you jump on the train and go out into the wilderness. That's how you love it. But just buying it isn't loving it. It suddenly becomes clutter. Well, you spent, I don't know, several thousand dollars or never use it. It's no good. So it's always been important to us to make sure that the person who thinks they want to buy it is going to love it, is going to use it. And even to the extent where if someone does buy it, we can help them use it. We can invite them to a ride. We can introduce them to new friends. And then suddenly they become part of this community and the community takes over and they're off.
We just had a very interesting tour of your factory. I think it's so much in the DNA that, it's so focused on the details and the quality has to be right. And everything, I think most of them are handmade, right? I'm quite interested why you come to China when China is about scale. So even people who eventually love Brompton and then so passionate about your brand and wanted to buy your bike, just the sheer size of that is huge, right? The way that your business model works on handmade. So you're probably not going to fulfill that many or that much love that quickly.
So for me, we've made 1 million bikes.
Yeah, we just saw the serial number.
So that's something to be proud of. And I was in Korea. Like I was saying, I was in Asia not that long ago. And I was riding with some customers, which is what I always do when I'm traveling. And there were a couple. His bike was 30 years old.
Wow.
Her bike was 20 years old. Perfectly fine. Nothing wrong with them. Loving it. So we sort of need to move away from this idea that everything is about selling tons of stuff as fast as possible, as quickly as possible. And as soon as you sold them something, what are you going to sell them next? How can they upgrade? How can they sell up? Planet Earth can't sustain that. We need to be buying things that last 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. You know, the worst culprit, I haven't got it, didn't want it to go off, is our little phone. That's a disgrace. Those things should last 5 years. And then what you should do is send them to somebody who upgrades them, and then they go into the African market for another 5 years or something. But they don't. They get chucked in the bin. So for us, we're a great believer of Warren Buffett. So in the 20 years that I've been at Brompton, we've grown 20% a year compound. We've got to 130 million turnover. If we grow 20% a year for the next 20 years, when I'm 70, we will be, I haven't done the maths, but well over billions. And we'll still be in business. And we won't have gone to venture capital. And we won't have borrowed millions and millions of pounds to, you know, chase the today's fad. We'll have created a really awesome business that is still looking after the customers of 30, 40-year-old bikes. You know, this guy, I spoke to a guy today, he was telling me about a business called Farfetched. I never even heard of them because you can tell fashion isn't my thing. And this is where the world's gone a bit bonkers. I'm only saying this because I literally spoke to him today. He was involved in them in the early days. And they went, they floated. Then they had a market valuation of $12 billion. What are they worth today? Nothing.
Nothing, yeah.
It's nonsense. We have a children's story about the emperor and his invisible clothes. We need to simplify our lives with really beautiful, like the Japanese, quality things that last and can be repaired, that are needed in our life, not peripheral sort of clutter. Because so much of what we buy, we don't need. So don't buy it. It's sucking the life out of planet Earth. It's sucking money out of us. So we have to work even harder to earn more money to buy stuff we don't need. Buy less stuff. Buy beautiful stuff. Buy stuff you can give to your children. And then you don't need to spend as much. And then you'd have to work as much. Then you can spend more time with your friends, more time riding your bike. Come on. And the planet will be happier. So yes, we may not be able to fulfill all the demand, but over 3, 4, 5 years, people might have to wait. And if they don't want to wait, then probably they didn't really want it. It was just a fad.
So you don't have the anxiety over the China scale that, oh, I gotta do something quick in order to tap into that scale.
20% a year. Warren Buffett. He's done all right. 20% a year, compound growth.
Yeah.
And if we can deliver that, the more important thing in China actually is looking after the customers we have. With our product in particular, when you sell it, you begin a journey. You don't sell the bike. Where's the next customer? Oh, who can we sell to next? It's like you sell. Right. Okay. How can we look after you? Introduce you to the community. Let's go for a ride. You've got a 10-year-old bike. Oh, well, you've got to look after it. You've got to care for these parts. We've still got spare parts. That's a real brand. And if we do the looking after the customer will do the selling for us. We don't have to worry about the selling. We just look after the customer. The customer will sell for us.
Now, because you have such a tremendous increase of demand in China, right, for your bike. But like you said, they will have to wait. So while they're waiting, I'm sure you know through your recent China visit that they're copies or the yes. Brompton Aspire, if you like, yes. right? So they're at a much cheaper price and they can turn around much quicker.
Yeah.
So you're not worried that some of the customers, just because they didn't have the patience to wait, so they were just got stolen or just got lured away by, I guess those are not the true love customers so of your brand.
For me, if we were making watches, I could sort of get that because if you buy a fake Rolex, you've had it for 3 or 4 years, you know it's fake. Maybe your friends don't. You do. And then it breaks. I mean, I got 4 years out of it. My friends thought I had a Rolex. I'm going to buy another one. You know, or your Louis Vuitton handbag. But a bike's a bit different. You see how we make it. We take care. We're not taking care because we just feel like it. We're taking care because we need to take care. If you get that wrong, it'll kill people. You're whizzing down a hill in Beijing or Shanghai or Shenzhen, or you're, you know, out in the wilderness in Chengdu, and that thing breaks. Will you smash your front teeth, you break your pelvis, and you get hit by a truck? Then was saving $200 worth it? Because the margins of our business are not big. We're not making massive profit margins. We're investing any profit we have back into the bike. And interestingly, the direct costs of the bike, what do you think the direct costs are? So if you look at the direct costs for this bike, labor and materials, what do you think the split is, having walked around the factory? How much labor goes into the bike and how much materials of the direct costs?
50-50 at least.
At the moment, 85% material.
Wow.
Only 15% labor.
My.
Now, that material cost is the same in Shanghai, in Pakistan, in Vietnam. That material cost, logistics costs are pretty minimal as a percentage. So the material cost is the same. We're buying 100,000 units, so we've got buying power. So, okay, maybe if you made it in China, you might be able to reduce the labor from 15 down to 5. It's not much. So you're getting value in that product, but the value is the quality. And it's whether you want to risk or decide to try something else. Of course you have the opportunity to do so, but even if we wanted to double, treble production, you can't, this isn't software. It's people, it's learning, it's skill. If you suddenly flood our factory with millions of new people, the quality will only go one way. You can't massively increase production when you're trying to make a really high quality product. It takes time, 20% a year, compound growth. Now, as it happens, we've grown in China more than 20% a year because Europe has decreased. So we've taken some of the capacity out of Europe and put it into China. But if you look at production globally, 20% a year.
Right. So you entered China 2012, so it's been more than 10 years.
Yeah.
Do you think the recent success of Brompton Bike in China is a sudden success because of pandemic, or it just over the years It's just that it so happened that it hit the tipping points during
yes,
the pandemic.
So I think both, actually.
Okay.
You know, there's a great saying, it takes 20 years to become an overnight success. China liked to do things faster. Took us like 10. But we definitely needed that tipping point because the Chinese consumer is very savvy. You need 10 years of trading. You need customers who've owned the bike for 8 years, 9 years to give you credibility. You can't just turn up and become a success. They don't trust that. You need to have that longevity and that trust from independent customers. And that took us 10 years to get that. So the tipping point is definitely important. But of course, we had a global pandemic, which, and to be fair, before the pandemic, I mean, this is my observation. When I first went to China, which was in 2006, I think, consumerism was about visible, following everyone else.
Show and tell.
Very show consumerism. And it was about consuming consumerism. It was like bags, watch. Mm. Well, even the watch is a bit small, but, you know, stuff people can see. That consumerism has become more and more sophisticated, more and more individual, more and more fragmented, and all the better for it. So actually, you are choosing a not so well-known brand, but with real depth and with real integrity. And you can storytell to your friends about why this says something about me and I'm different and individual. That's a big change.
Mm-hmm.
But over the same period, you know, when I first went to Beijing, the air quality was so bad. Mm-hmm. We were told not to leave our flat. Now, the transformation has been incredible.
Yes.
But that journey has had an impact on people. The way people think about their own health, about the environment, about how they live their lives, the younger generation is radically different to that of the generation above.
Mm.
So there is also a macro trend in China about personal well-being, about the environment, about leisure, about camping, getting outside of the city, all of which plays into what we're doing. So you've got a tipping point. You've gone got a macro shift into consumer behavior in China, and then you got COVID. Mm-hmm. I think all three of those came together.
Mm-hmm.
And then that meant that we had the right product with enough credibility in the right place at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, there's a great song by Katie Malula called 10 Billion Bikes or 10 Million Bikes in Beijing. And of course, the first time I went to Beijing, there were no bikes. There were none. There were amazing bike lanes, but there was it was me in it. Nobody else. Massive bike lane.
You and your Brompton.
But we want to bring the bikes back to Beijing and to Shanghai and to Shenzhen and to Chengdu because, you know, it's such a cultural fit. Now, the Brompton will never be a mass market product. It never will be. And that's fine. But if we can be the catalyst to make cycling cool again, because that's what we're doing. Cool people are riding our bike. And once cool people do something, everyone else is allowed to do it.
Mm.
So if we can help be a catalyst to change the culture of moving and living in cities in China, and if people then go and buy 50 million pigeon bikes or flying pigeon bikes or whatever, that's fine. We have contributed, not directly, but indirectly, into making the world a little bit better.
Mm.
It isn't all about money. You know, when you speak to somebody, I was at my dad's 85th yesterday, and he's super fit, super healthy, still working, legend, a real inspiration. But he's not interested in things, in money. He's interested in time, in legacy, in the impact he has had over his life. And that we should remember and recognize at a younger age, because that's what I'm interested in. When I, you know, pop off, and it might be tomorrow if I'm unlucky, or it might be when I'm 85 or 90. But the bit I'll look back on is, I mean, money. Well, it's, you know, you need a certain amount, but come on. We've got to care for society and the planet and do lovely, beautiful things that make people happy.
Mm. Now, your observations of the Chinese consumers, do you think those are very much first-tier cities like Beijing, Shanghai, Shenzhen? I don't know, in your recent visit, have you had a chance to go to a second-tier city, third-tier city?
So, I would say you are right that is definitely first-tier. Maybe some second-tier cities, because some of those second-tier cities are like way bigger than what we would consider a, you know, first tier city.
Mm.
And the speed of development, I mean, somewhere like Chengdu, which has changed hugely. I went there a long time ago and I haven't been there since, but I've spoken to a lot of people who have, and, you know, they're the amazing transformation, particularly in cycling infrastructure, I mean, everything. So we don't have the capacity to take on all cities in China. So when you're in business, our brand is bigger than our business. You know, the brand is quite big. We are not so big. We're still human, little, and care. And so one of the reasons, or one of the rules of business is, you know, you've just got to keep quite focused and not try and do too much. And if we can sort out 12 cities in China and do it really well, not just sell bikes, but be part of the community that changes how people want to live in that city, and work with the infrastructure, the architects, the design, the culture, the celebration of cycling. And you look back, and we've done that in London, we've done that in Brussels, we've done that in Barcelona, we've done it to a degree in New York. Then you're getting somewhere. And that is a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
So not to spread yourself too thin is also important, because, I mean, I must have happened to me, I mean, I can't say how many times, oh, you know, I love Brompton. I'm going to open 50 shops. Yeah, 2 years, we're going to finish. Yeah, we sell loads of bikes. We're millionaires. Yeah, yeah, come on. I'm going to invest. Like, oh, come on.
VC talk.
And there's so much. You know, it's like, no, bit by bit.
Right.
You know.
Talking about your brand, I don't know if you know, but your team in China probably told you the consumers or the loyal users of Brompton Bikes has given you a nickname.
Yes.
Xiaobu.
Xiaobu.
Right?
That's right.
Not all international brands earn a nickname. Only brands that people find unique.
Cute.
Some cute, some unique.
Yeah.
Some represent a very different personality and characteristic that earn a nickname.
Yes.
Is that only in China, or in many other places in the world you also have nicknames?
So, we don't have anything as gorgeous as Xiaobu anywhere else in the world, because it's so cute.
Yes, it is.
And I love it. I think it's so cool. I haven't told my wife, but what I really want to do is get a tattoo of Xiaobu. And then, of course, no one will know what it is, but I will. And I think Brompton's a bit naff, but Xiaobu would be quite cool. Anyway, but we do have, what is interesting about this little bike is it is modest.
Mm.
It's got more capability than you think. Your brain tells you what it is, but then when you use it, you realize it has more. It delivers more, and that's endearing. But what we have found is this bike has changed people's lives, and there aren't many products that do that. It's not going to solve the world's problems. It's going to help, but it has made people feel better. It's made them happier. It's unlocked opportunity in their life. And as a result of that, and there are thousands and thousands of people, their Bromptons have names. They really are part of the family. They have memories, adventures. They've met people through them. We've had marriages. So this bike, just because it genuinely has a real impact on your life, that creates an endearment and a love. But has any sort of community, I mean, I call mine my Brommy, but that's a bit boring. But no, Xiaobu is the best.
When did the name Xiaobu start? Do you know?
No idea.
It must have started with influencers.
See, we haven't done influencers. I mean, they're just people who happen to have bought our bike and talk about it.
Mm.
But it'd be really interesting, before everyone forgets, to try and see, because the trouble with social media and all that, if you don't record it, you can't find the video of 5 years ago. It's disappeared into the ether.
Mm.
It's so lovely, and I absolutely love it.
There is an analogy by a very big influencer who happens to be a Brompton user. He thought that Brompton bike is the Mini Cooper of bicycle.
I think there's some truth in that.
Mm.
The most important thing is we have to be able to be different, to not be afraid to stand out if we're going to solve the world's problems. The Brompton it's cute, but it's a bit peculiar. And when you first see one, you're like, you know, so that you need a little bit of self-confidence to take that first step. And I think that's that Andrew, who invented the bike exists against the odds. Everyone told him it was a bad idea. It wouldn't work. It was stupid. I mean, 13 years of ridicule, of knockbacks, of being looked down upon and laughed at. But he didn't give up because he believed in it. If the tiny message is we all have to do our bit to stand up and say what we see and work together to solve some of these problems, because, you know, I have a family. I've had a blooming brilliant time on planet Earth. I want generations to come to have a brilliant time. And there are some things going on that concern me. But I know as an engineer, we can fix them all. And we're such smart, brilliant people on planet Earth, but we just need to have the confidence to challenge and to come up with new ideas. And innovation is challenge. Innovation is not doing what everyone else does. It's doing something different. And I think the sort of people that ride our bike are prepared to be different. They're a little bit edgy. They maybe don't follow the crowd. And I think that's delightful. And if that resonates, all the better.
You mentioned that the belief behind the brand is to make the world a better place, right?
Yep.
Through bike cycling. And you mentioned, you know, persistence or insistence. But in China, Brompton bike is on a pricey end.
Yep.
So you will have users who got criticism. This is just a show and tell.
Yep.
You're just showing off your wealth,
yep.
Right? Is that something that you anticipated?
Yes, because we have been in Japan. And we've been in Singapore and Hong Kong. We have seen that. And we've seen when a product becomes trendy, you will get some people who will buy it who don't even know why they're buying it. They just want one. That's dangerous because that's a very shallow hit. This is not cheap. This is built for 30 years, 40 years of use. It's not built to be sitting in the corner and dusted like a hi-fi. If you spend your money on something and you don't use it, you're not going to love it. So it's going to weaken the brand. So actually, an important part of what we do is encouraging people when they do buy to ride, introducing them to communities. I mean, our brand in China is about community. It's about meeting people. And actually,
is it just China or it's pretty much the same everywhere?
Asia.
Yeah. Oh.
Less so in Europe.
Okay.
Less so in North America, but across Asia. And that originally came out of Japan, Singapore, massive, Hong Kong. I mean, community is so important. And I think there is a slight theme because in Asia, 25 years ago, life was two things, family and work. That was it. Very little time for anything else. Over the last 20, 25 years, recreation, socializing outside of family has become a bigger, growing thing. But actually, it's quite intimidating. It isn't deep in the culture. It's not like everyone has dinner parties. In Europe, there's a lot of dinner parties, people coming around to your house, going to university, leaving home, very, very social, structural upbringing. That is not so strong across Asia. And I think a lot of people latched on to social media for friendship. But this sort of friend can only last so long. You know, it hasn't got depth. And what's another fascinating thing with Brompton, if you buy a Brompton, you will be part of a community. You will meet interesting people and they become real. And you do real things and you go to a cafe or you all jump on a train and somebody organizes to do something fun. And it brings this sort of ticket into a world of interesting things, new communities, meeting different and varied people. And I think actually that was something we didn't anticipate, that the bike became a facilitator for friendship. And we now better understand that because we've been in Asia for 20 years. But when we first went to Asia, I remember when Andrew and I went to Japan, I'd been there already. He'd never been to Asia. And I finally persuaded and dragged him out to Japan.
Good for you.
And he was mortified. The bikes were all pristine. There wasn't a speck of dirt on them. But they can't love these bikes. They're not using them. They're immaculate. And they're like, yeah, we use them every weekend. It doesn't look like you use them. There's hardly a speck or two. No, but then we spend 1 hour cleaning them. What? You know, Andrew's bike covered in shit, scratches, all.
Yes.
And he can't understand it. He didn't think they loved it because it was too clean. But he didn't realize that they loved it even more. That's why it was so clean. We've been on this journey of learning. What's so lovely is Andrew created a bike for himself.
Hmm.
He didn't create it for an opportunity. He didn't do market. He wanted one. That was it, plain and simple. His needs were quite unusual. So he needed a flexible product to give him what he needed. In creating that flexible product, it's flexible that it, in a different way, with its flexibility, delivers a solution to that type of person and to that type of person. And all these different people interpret what he's created for their own use. And that has been another joy of this bike, because the bike has taught us things that we didn't even know.
Mm. I saw among your Chinese users community, some of them are so passionate, so devoted to Brompton, that if they're a designer, they're engineer, they will come up with accessories they invented.
Yes, of course.
For the use of, better parking or
Brompton. Yes.
And then other users will start it, place order demand. Yes. Like, can you make more for me?
Yes.
It's a bit like when Andrew started with Brompton, right?
It is a bit like that. I mean, what is great, and the thing is, innovation comes in many forms.
Mm.
But one of the best innovators are your customers. We've got a million of those. You should never underestimate. And we've got engineers. We've got product designers. We've got architects. You know, these are smart people coming up with ideas, thinking about how they can make it better. We love that because we are watching it and we learn from our customers. The thing the customer doesn't understand is how to make something both safe and compliant.
Mm.
They're not necessarily the same thing. Compliance is a minefield. There's an element of safety and compliance, but some of it is the products you use and how you use them, et cetera, et cetera. And our customers can sometimes get a bit frustrated because they will see a solution and ask us why we're not doing it. And in some cases, it simply isn't safe.
Mm.
It's fine for someone to do for their friends, but in some cases, it's actually, we've had situations where people really, really hurt themselves. So all I would say on that is have so much fun with your bike, but be very careful with structural integrity, upgrading that.
Mm-hmm.
If it breaks and it might hurt you, then be very careful. If it's fun, if it's a stand, if it's lights, if it's gizmos, go for it. But if it's down to the core structural integrity, be very wary, because lots of things look great, but it needs to be great after 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. Mm-hmm. And if it breaks, it hurts.
Have you had such an episode where?
Yes, we have.
Okay. Are you willing to share one?
We can't. We took a decision not to, because it sounds a bit like we're dissing other people.
Okay.
And to be honest, we want people to innovate. Mm. But all I ever say is just be careful with structural integrity.
Right.
Everything else, have fun. But we love it because it's stimulating our designers. Hey, guys, have you seen this? You know, these guys. And when we visit China and you look at people's bikes, oh, what's going on here? Hey, cool. Where did you get that? It's brilliant.
So you will take also the consumer's invention and thought that's practical and also safe and compliant.
Well, what we tend to do is take the idea and then we refine it, optimize it, make sure it's genuinely engineered, and then reintroduce it back.
Okay, but would you let new user know that that's an inspiration?
Yes. But the funny thing is, there is no one user. So what you'll find is you've got probably across the world 15 or 20 people coming up with different variants of a solution that they think's better.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can take elements of that, sort of morph it into something that is scalable, safe, robust, and compliant.
Mm-hmm.
It's not easy. It takes time. And also, because we're a global brand and we're dealing with something that might kill somebody, you have to pass compliance in America. In Japan, it's different. Mm. In China, in Indonesia. So they're all different. So you can't just create something that's compliant for China. It needs to also be, so you might have to adjust it to be compliant for China and America.
Mm.
So getting it so it's actually truly global is a bit trickier.
Okay. Talk about innovation. As a potential customer, I haven't bought any, but I wanted to because the wait in China is so long. Your most recent innovation is the Brompton bike hire. I saw that in London.
So no, We've had that for 13 years.
Really?
Yes.
But I only saw the lockers in London my last visit.
Takes 20 years to become an overnight success.
Of course. Ah.
Slowly catch the monkey.
So that business model has been around.
13 years.
Oh, my.
And I can tell you the first seven were really, really tough. Because we learned so much and people were nicking the bikes and technology.
Yeah, I was going to ask you.
And, you know, Wi-Fi and Bluetooth and solar power and But unlike Mobike and Ofo and Blue, you know, piles of bikes meant to save the world and they're just destroying the world. We went small. We went slow. We learned from our mistakes. Then we scale.
Right.
We don't go to VC. Yeah. 200 million, you know, bam, 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 and just disaster.
Okay.
Compound growth. And we make mistakes, but we learn from them and we adjust and then we refine and then we look after our customers if we got it wrong and we do our best to look after them and on we go.
Okay.
Because this relationship is for 30 years. There was a company called VanMoof. I don't know if you heard of them. They raised $250 million. They produced the best e-bike, the best urban e-bike. They were fantastic. They were the best thing since the new Tesla of bikes.
Mm.
Now they got bust.
Right.
But that's not fair on the customer. I mean, if you're making beer and you go bust, who cares? You've drunk the beer, it's finished. But the poor customer that bought the bike, what do they do now? Where do they get their spare parts? Where do they get a software upgrade? The business doesn't exist. So that all of those customers have been let down. And when you buy from a brand, it's not just about today. It's about where... Who's going to look after you in 5 years, in 10 years, in 20 years? That's what the commitment is.
Mm-hmm.
It's for the life of the product. And that's a real commitment. And that's sort of what you're paying for. You're paying to be looked after for a long, long time.
But why did you even start Brompton Bike Hire? Because you have so many orders to fulfill already.
So
why even start it?
You always need to be paranoid about sales. Because sales is the one part of your business you're not directly in control of. I'm in control of the staff we hire. I'm in control of innovation, manufacturing, but sales, I can influence, but I'm not in control of it. So if you want to keep growing, you need to be building that sales pipeline 3-4 years before you need it. So that by the time you get there and you're investing for it, it's there. What we found with our bike is in the UK, brand recognition is very, very high. So 40% of people are aware of Brompton, very high brand recognition.
Wow.
But they didn't own a Brompton. They like it. Oh, yeah, I like Brompton. Oh, yeah, it looks really great. Don't own one. Why not? Oh, it's quite expensive. It is expensive. So they're aware of the brand, but it's too expensive. Now, why is it too expensive? It's too expensive because they don't understand the value proposition. They can't see how is it relevant in my life? How is it going to change my life? How is it going to add value? If you let someone borrow one for a week, not for a quick ride around the car park, but for a week, take it home, take it on the tube, fold it up, put it in the back of the car, take it into a restaurant, and then you ask them whether they think it's worth having, they go, oh my God, I love it. I love it. I want one. Because they now know, they get it. They understand how it works. They've ridden it. They've felt the freedom. Then they're, right, I want to buy one. So in our bike hire, 20% of people that take a bike from Bike Hire go on and buy one.
Wow. So you've been tracking them as well.
Yep.
Oh, wow. 20% so conversion rate.
20% it's conversion really rate. It's very high. So it acts as a bridge. You can hire a bike for £5 a day. You can take it for a week. You might go to Paris for a long weekend, take a couple of Bromptons, go on the Eurostar, go to Paris. So this idea that allowing people to experience the bike, to take it not just for a little ride, but for a week. And then, of course, if they buy one, they can take the rental cost off the purchase price.
That's a good scheme.
Then we're getting somewhere. So it's all about innovation, trying different things, learning. Now, you know, you've got to just be slow. Compound growth. Yeah, there are so many interesting things with bike hire and dock in a shop and subscription. And we're getting there.
But I look at the locker, I register an account, right? I haven't passed the ID, so
yep.
I couldn't rent one. But I was standing in front of your locker thinking, if I open a locker, I rent one.
Yeah.
I don't know how do you track that when I return it, it is an authentic bike, not a counterfeit that I return.
Oh, because it's chipped.
Oh, okay.
We know your bike.
I see.
We don't know where you're going.
Right.
We don't know how far you've ridden. where we know how many miles you've done, but we don't know where the miles are. But we have a sensor inside the dock.
Mm-hmm.
We have a sensor in the bike, so we know who you are because of your phone. We know when you take the bike, and then we know when you put it back. And we're charging you per 24 hours.
Mm. You're a CEO. How do you stay innovative this whole time?
Do you know, I'm an engineer. The amazing thing about engineering is it doesn't stop. Things are happening, material science, powerful computers, robotics.
Mm.
There is so much cool stuff going on planet Earth in terms of engineering that something that I've wanted to do with a bike that was impossible 8 years ago is possible today. So the engineering advances are just unlocking innovation because things that I just couldn't imagine doing is now possible. 3D printing, bonding, you know, FEA, finite analysis. We're doing some stuff that is off the chart.
Wow.
Right at the cutting edge. Wow. I mean, we have got so much stuff. We just can't get it out there fast enough.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to do it in stages. But I'm having to hold everyone back because mm-hmm. it's so cool what's going on. And ultimately, it's just about making a better bike. That's all it is. We need to make the bike better. But don't get me wrong. I had two customers in Korea. They didn't need the newest bike. They were on a 30-year-old bike and they love them and they use them and they're brilliant. So let's not get so caught up on new. I could sell you a bike that was 10 years old. You'd love it. My bike at home is 10 years old.
Mm.
I'm using it all the time. I was riding out on it this weekend. It's brilliant. So this newness, it delivers opportunity. But don't forget, the thing's awesome.
So you're engineering, so you still get your hands dirty by playing around all this new technology, new gadgets.
So I'm always riding prototypes.
Oh.
Not when I travel, because mm-hmm. then I get into trouble. Mm-hmm. So it's all meant to be secrets. How on earth nobody in London has photographed me riding these bikes? I mean, I've even met people and they go, are you the CEO? Yeah, we get chatting. And I'm riding a complete prototype. They don't even realize.
They probably felt it's quite rude to take a photo of you.
Maybe.
Without.
But I mean, so I love it. And what I love is the people I employ are better than me. They're doing things I didn't even know was possible. It's so exciting and I'm learning so much. I mean, we did some stuff that I discovered before Christmas. It's a long way away, but I'm like, oh my God, that is cool. You know, and I studied material science. I didn't think what they showed me was possible. And they said, Will, this is possible. I'm like, that is so cool. It is so exciting. What's possible? What's coming down the track? But, and this is the other thing, talking about a brand, we have bigger profit margin, not net profit, but gross profit.
Mm.
And we invest that in innovation. So some of the money that someone spends on a Brompton is going to the Brompton in 5 years' time.
Mm.
The person who's copying us, all they do is copy. They just want money. We do all the research. We take all the risk. We make all the mistakes. And once we've got it right, they just go, oh, yeah, let's copy. So when you invest in a brand, you're investing in the future for others as well.
Hmm.
Because that's where our money goes. It's into taking risk. Because whenever you do R&D, 70%, you hit a dead end. But you've got to try it to find out.
Hmm.
We're not spending our money on some celebrity endorser. We're spending it on real engineering to try and create better products. And, you know, that's a philosophical decision that people have to make when they decide what they're going to buy.
What's the percentage of your R&D to your...
R&D at the moment is about between 6.5% and 7%.
Wow. Okay.
So it's high.
Yeah, it is high.
And that's both capital, OPEX and staff mm-hmm. all together. These products, you know, the titanium bike, T-Line, that was in my head as an imaginary thing for 10 years. I could see it. I could touch it. I knew roughly how much it would weigh, but it was just, it was a dream. So when those things were coming off the line, I mean, I ride one. I love it. I was just like, that is awesome. And, you know, we've sold, I don't know, 7,000, so maybe 8,000. We make it all in our factory in Sheffield. That's so cool.
Yeah, we just had a test ride on. Not test ride, but my first ever ride.
And it's so just cool. It's a real privilege.
Mm. Your recent visit to China.
Yeah.
What's the biggest nice surprise and what's the biggest not so nice surprise?
The biggest nice surprise for me, funnily enough, was the concern you raised earlier about people buying the bike to sort of bling. When I last went to China, I think there was more of that. Now, it may just be that the people I met were the really hardcore enthusiasts, but I mean, even forget it. When I was cycling through both Beijing and Shanghai, I saw Bromptons. I spoke to probably 300 people, customers, while I was there, and I'd say 70% of them are using it as a mode of transport. They're using it to get around Beijing or to get around. And to me, one thing is to use it at the weekend for recreation, but to use it during the week to actually move around the city, that is awesome because that's deep, deep passion. And to me, that was so positive. And that, I mean, the cycling in Beijing and Shanghai is so lovely. The cycle lanes are gorgeous. I mean, you, why wouldn't you? And I was cycling past traffic jams and I'm just whizzing along. I'm in the shade because they've got the trees over the cycle lane. I mean, it's, it's fantastic. So that was the most heartening thing. What was the least positive thing that I saw when I was traveling? I want to see less cars in cities. You know, what has been achieved both in Shanghai and Beijing. I didn't get down to Shenzhen. I had to cancel that because I just could not fit everything in. But what has been achieved really, and considering we had 2 years of COVID as well, which stopped everything, the speed of change in those cities and the commitment in China to healthy living in cities is really there. You can feel it. But we've still got a long way to go. You know, and I was spending most of my time pedaling past traffic jams, like mile upon mile of like three wide traffic jams. And of course, there are restrictions on car ownership in Shanghai. There are restrictions on car ownership in Beijing, but still consumes the city. We're getting there. We should be proud of what we've achieved. And I say, when I say we, I mean the cycling community and the town planners and the government representatives, because there is real progress. I want to be more radical. I mean, we want to do, we're trying to sort out this event in Beijing. If we can pull that off, oh my God, we're going to light a firework or two. Have some real fun.
My last question. Your flagship store, it's in Beijing, just opening in October. But I would have thought between Beijing and Shanghai, it would be Shanghai that would you will open a flagship.
I mean, what is a flagship store? It's our Shanghai store is gorgeous if you get a chance to go there. Our Beijing store is a bit bigger. I mean, all I want is a lovely store to have our customers to enjoy themselves. The thing that we've brought to Beijing that we didn't do in Shanghai, and of course we're on a journey, is we put in space for our community. And that's quite a luxury because you're not selling in that space. You're just giving over space so that then you can have events. People can all come upstairs. They can have an area to chat. They can have cups of tea, coffee. That's our first sort of step towards remembering that brand is about the customers. It's not just about selling and renting space to give to our community. That's a first step. And then we've also got a little coffee shop in there. And so it's a bit of an experiment. It's a cost, but it forces the team to think we need to use that space. We need to bring the community together. We need to do evening events. We need to do weekend events. We need to, that's part of our job. It's not just about selling. So that's why that store is bigger and we'll learn from it. And we have fun ideas. I'd like to have some fun in Shenzhen, but you just got to be careful because remember, turnover is vanity. Profit is sanity and cash is king. So you've got to just make sure business is sustainable and we can be there in 10 or 20 years.
Thank you so much, Will. First of all, to get a first-hand download from the brand CEO himself is precious. And also, I'm so glad that you talk so much about brand because that's something that a lot of people, particularly in China, have forgotten because they all went after scale.
Yeah. Right?
And they use a lot of product news to get that scale up and therefore to get the funding in and therefore to go IPO. And like you said, years later, they no longer existed. It's all about capital gain, right? But it's not about consumer. It's not about community. It's not about users. So it's really refreshing to hear you talk about it. And you're in the long game.
I am.
You're not like, you know, converting money at a short term and therefore, you know, pack up and go. You're in the long term, which is really refreshing. And I'm hoping that a lot of my listeners, if they're business owners or they're brand manager, brand directors of whether it's not multinational brands or Chinese brands, this is a story, a real story that we can learn from. Don't go after speed and scale because those may not last.
It's about building solid foundations and being able to look at your children and your grandchildren when the time comes and say, I made the world just a tiny weeny bit better. That'll be the test when our time comes to depart. And if you are doing something that isn't contributing to that, you will have some guilt when you look at your children, your grandchildren, because it's not a joke. And I think business has such a responsibility to not just care about money and shareholder value. It's about the planet and the community that live on it that we will be ultimately tested.
Mm-hmm. So much respect. Thank you so much, Will.
My pleasure.